because of the U.S. Surgeon General's report on the extent of opioid addiction in America. Today we'll hear from a voice who recognized the problem among his own patients long ago. Hilo Dr. Frederick Nida puts a spotlight on East Hawaii. And we'll get the ground's eye view of homelessness from the head of Hope Services. Janice Ikeda joins us this hour. From the Lyman Museum in Hilo, I'm Beth Ann Koslovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook from our HPR studio on Kaheka Street. We'll get a look inside Hilo's Lyman Museum with trustee and docent Bruce McClure, and a powerful multimedia production at UH Hilo evokes the ghosts of Hiroshima. We'll talk with director Jackie Pualani Johnson.
It's Friday, November 18th. That's The Conversation, coming up right after this news. Good morning and welcome to The Conversation, this day from two islands. I'm Beth Ann Koslovich over in Hilo, where at the moment it's gray and raining, a Hilo-type day. It's beautiful, though, as far as we're concerned. And over in our Kaheka studio, Chris, you there?
I sure am, Beth Ann. Good morning. It's so near and yet so far away, right?
Oh, the magic of voices meeting in the ether. Yeah, I love that part. Anyway, good to talk to you, and we're going to just carry on with this morning. Now, island to island, homelessness in Hawaii looks different. We know that. The numbers of singles, families, and chronically homeless people battling addiction and mental illness shift with other variables, rural and urban areas, and an island's general population. What doesn't shift is the need to help people for whom a tent or a makeshift pallet on concrete is home. And while it can be tempting to see homeless people through numbers on reports, the clearer picture emerges from the firsthand experience of the people who know their clients best, the outreach workers. Today, we're in Hilo with Janice Ikeda, Operations Director for Hope Services Hawaii, to hear what she sees. Janice, thank you so much for coming in this morning.
Aloha. Thank you for having me on such a momentous week for homelessness, as it is the National Hunger and Homelessness Awareness Week. We've had a number of events that happened this week. We kicked off the week with a number of homeless vigils. On the west side, we had a gathering of the faith community. Today, we have our homeless luncheon in Hilo. Yesterday, it was over in Kona, and tomorrow will be in Pahoa.
Right. There are lots of things that are happening that are focusing our attention on it this month. But for you, that happens every single day. And for the people who are out there on the streets who are trying to make a difference, it happens every single day. Now, we looked at the point in time count, which in just a few months will be done again, and seeing that in Hawaii County, it increased by 12%. Sheltered folks increased by 23% compared to 2015. Unsheltered was 10%. And looking at the factors of why we've seen this increase, particularly on Hawaii Island, of the fact that there was better reporting this year. What did that mean in terms of how those collaborative efforts happened? And I know you were involved with that.
Well, it was really key having the County of Hawaii partner with us this year. We had the first responders partnering with us. We also had the Office of Housing and Community Development partnering with us. And they're key partners throughout the year because they're the ones that issue out those Section 8 vouchers that a lot of our homeless folks take advantage of. We also had the Civil Defense Agency partnering with us. And that was during a time when Hawaii County was facing dengue fever outbreak. And so for them being out in the field and really getting a firsthand view of the people who are most susceptible to those kinds of disasters, was really key. We also had business partners, and that was amazing to have people in the businesses who typically come to us because they want us to move the homeless people away from their businesses, but for them to be able to connect on a real personal and human level to people who are homeless and realize a lot of them are working folks, and to break down a lot of the stereotypes that they may have had, and just building community relationships really was really
I mean, it sounds as if you had the community come together in unprecedented ways, and that they all walked away with a different lesson. As you're now looking at the next point in time count, where we're not looking at so many, you know, issues in the way that they were focused because of dengue fever, What is that you think might be happening this next time around, or what are you going to try to make happen this next time around so you get that same community cohesion and sense of everyone doing this together in concert with each other?
Mm-hmm. Well, throughout the year, we continue to work together as partners. And like I mentioned, bringing the faith community into the conversation. We held a landlord summit earlier this year and brought together landlords and property managers and brought them into the conversation. And that's been really key too, because the only way to really end homelessness is putting people into homes. And so having the partnership with those people in that have the homes, it was really key, and continuing to build those relationships throughout the year and that conversation. But going back to your point about seeing the increase in the shelters, another thing that contributed to that may not have been reported in the point in time is the shift towards housing first and the shelter being a low barrier shelter, which means that people are no longer required to be clean and sober. We don't do UAs on them. Shelter is for that transition from homelessness to housing. And what the housing first model does is, once they get into housing, that's when you wrap around services and case management, because they're no longer in crisis and they're much more open and able to change.
And housing first has been an issue that we've been talking about for quite a while statewide, mm-hmm. certainly in Honolulu, but every island seems to have a different version of what housing first looks like for homeless people and what might be massaged into that, because there were a lot of federal dollars flowing into that from HUD. We now have a real change happening in Washington. Are you concerned at all about how that's going to affect how you do what you do?
No, because we've already made the shift. And so for our shelters, one of the things that we did was we got rid of 4 pages and over 100 rules that people needed to adhere to in our shelter. And of course, if they didn't adhere to it in the past, they'd get violations and get kicked out. Well, now there's just 6 agreements, really, and it all aligns to good tenant behaviors, and building good tenant behaviors with the goal of permanent housing. So going from 100-something rules and UAing people and, citing them for violations on curfew and everything else, down to just 6 agreements of, how you treat one another, basically keeping your unit clean and paying your program fees on time, has made a big difference in how people are able to utilize the shelters.
So what lessons do you think other islands can take away from, and other places can take away from, what you've been able to do in Hilo and West Hawaii too?
The biggest lesson is moving away from social control and really getting into true social service.
And what's the difference?
It has to do with power and control, really, over another person. And are you there to exercise power and control? Are you really there to serve them? And are they and their needs first and foremost, and realizing that their first and foremost need is housing, beyond charity, beyond anything else, it's housing.
With the growth of a lot of substandard housing, people living in tents or makeshift structures, no running water, no utility access, any of that, how have you been able to shift them into your vision? Has it been difficult? I mean, are people willing to come in?
It is difficult. And we live on an island that's over 4,000 square miles. When we look at the population on the west side compared to the population on the east side, it's just two very, very different communities. Even the population that's down in Kau area, very different again. There's a lot of families in the Kau area who are Kofa families, and the assistance that was available to that community there was very limited. And so we're thankful that recently, through the Coordinated Statewide Homeless Initiative, through an agreement with the governor and Aloha United Way, that has opened up sources of funding that we've been able to assist those families.
And going forward, because we've got to go in just a minute, but going forward, how concerned are you about being able to access funding?
It's very concerning, especially with the new Senate Bill 2559 that is requiring the spaces in the emergency shelters. That's going to decrease the number of shelter beds that we have available. And so that's concerning.
We'll talk to you more in future, but I want to thank you for coming in today and being with us here in Hilo.
Okay, mahalo nui.
Janice Ikele is Director of Operations for Hope Services Hawaii. Last year, she helped the organization align with the Housing First model and made East and West Hawaii operations more cohesive.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:13, and coming up in the show, the ghosts of Hiroshima still very much with us. But first, your quiz.
For kids who grew up in Hawaii during the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, collecting milk bottle caps used to be a popular game. Rules were simple. Players would stack their bottle caps art side up and try to hit the stack with a slammer, and then collect any flipped over caps. As time passed, glass milk bottles were replaced by cardboard containers, and kids were able to replenish their supply of bottle caps by collecting pieces issued by the Haleakala Dairy attached to their tropical juice drink called POG. It's an acronym for passion fruit, orange, guava, and hence the colloquial name of the game. But did you know that POGs also have been used as a means of currency for deployed American soldiers? They're printed with the value of 5, 10, and 25 cents. For today's backyard quiz, can you tell us who issues these monetary POGs? If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get it right gets the prize.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Kaiser Permanente and Hastings and Pleadwell, a communication company.
The August 1945 bombing of civilian targets in two Japanese cities claimed hundreds of thousands of lives and cast a shadow over the world that may never go away. And if we lose sight of the lessons it left behind, we'll be doomed to repeat them. The UH Hilo Performing Arts Center production of The Ghosts of Hiroshima will bring those lessons to the stage tonight. And we spoke with director Jackie Pualani Johnson about the show's effect on a new generation.
The young people in the cast have had their eyes opened. The students who came to dress rehearsal last night, I already received a write-up from one of them talking, and specifically she said, we millennials need to realize what is going on around us and take action. So I was thrilled that immediately there was that sense that we've learned a great deal about what the potentials of nuclear force and weaponry and common everyday use.
For so many of them, their parents and even their grandparents, I know I've never lived a life that wasn't under the shadow of nuclear conflict, although,
yeah.
You know, and it's affected the whole post-war period. But you do wonder if that consciousness that, you know, mankind has the potential to destroy itself, you wonder if people are as aware of it as they were, say, in the decades right after the bombing.
I don't think as aware, that's probably true, but we're hoping with this production that we can move this forward again, put the agenda there for people to look at carefully. One of the things the student wrote about was that she was very pleased with the way that the show represents both what we Americans think about the beauty of science and, you know, discovery and all of that, and what the scientists said after they actually realized they had created this incredible potential earth-destroying kind of science, and balancing that with what the very simple, powerful messages of those who survived. The students noted that there's that kind of fascination, and then there's that tragedy of living it and having your life so radically changed.
Enormous con- conflict for the scientists themselves. I'm thinking of J. Robert Oppenheimer's quote from the Bhagavad Gita, "I am become death, destroyer
that
of worlds."
That is the closing line of the show.
I'm not surprised.
Yeah, that's coupled with what it says actually at the Hiroshima Memorial site, too. Because that's the thing about this show. It looks at both sides. You hear the survivors' stories, the Hibakusha, their stories. And then it puts that fascinating thing about we want to discover, but when we learn that a discovery can go awry, we have to make sure that we make the right decisions in the future. And then it ends with that hopeful note that those in Hiroshima and elsewhere have this cause celebre now to go ahead and make sure the rest of the world realizes what it means.
Well, you know, on a theoretical level, science moved inevitably toward the ability to split the atom and therefore create that enormous destructive force. But also you have the momentum generated by 5 years of warfare leading up to it, right? That, you know, hideous though it may seem, there was a reason why those bombs were dropped.
And I agree with you. I think that in war, all kinds of things that we wish were rules do not exist because war is war. But I do think that what we learned from the use of nuclear weaponry is another story, and it goes in another direction, and I think that's an important part of it. One of the things that we've added to the program, the show itself deals with everything in the 1980s, when the Hibakusha were still alive, and we were really at a huge peak, 70,000 warheads. We do have some information in our program that we're down to about 15,000, if you can say down to about 15,000.
Yeah.
And then the different packs that our nations have agreed to try to control. But there's kind of stasis right now. They haven't moved too far enough forward to say we need to get this out of our lives. So hopefully there'll be more awareness as a result.
Well, yeah, the irony of saying that now we only have the potential to destroy the planet 10 times over
as
opposed to 50 times over, that counts as progress in the nuclear age.
That's so true. And the point is made in the program, in this play, that those two bombs for Hiroshima and Nagasaki were basically, these days, would be triggers. And you multiply by the millions of the effects, the number of people who would be killed, et cetera, how the world would be devastated.
They routinely describe nuclear devices in terms of the multiples of the power of the Hiroshima bomb.
Yes.
10 times, 50 times, whatever.
The line in the show is, those bombs are the size of a pea, and today everything's the size of a cantaloupe, you know, by comparison. Yeah.
Your cast members must be really telling you a lot about the changes working in this show have put them through.
And we have a wonderful, diverse cast. We have people of different ages, backgrounds. There was someone who was a military recruiter for many years. So this goes beyond a lot of those kinds of allegiances, the idea of saving the world from something that could destroy it forever. It kind of cuts across all of the ages, generations, philosophies, and it's really nice to see that. The taiko drummers that we have are from a Taishoji mission here in Hilo, and of course a lot of that undercurrent is about peace. And so it seems like we're reflecting this common thread, regardless of people's backgrounds and their visions, is that peace is just a necessity.
And, you know, one of the ironies, the multiple ironies of this, is that many peace initiatives today are directly related to the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings.
It is an irony, yeah. Yeah, it is. You know, one of the things that's going to happen that will become known after our Sunday closing performance is we were approached by the Yoshida family here in Hilo, and they have seen some trees that survived the bombing. What's going to happen is that they are asking UH Hilo to be the repository in our Department of Agriculture of those seeds through Dr. Norman Arancon, and we will be the place that will reach out to the rest of the world to spread those seeds of hope and peace and hopefully regenerate them in other settings. It's called the Green Legacy. It was a stunning thing to have surfaced while we were working on this production. And we will have a little ceremony on Sunday with the passing of the seeds into the hands of the university professor.
That's a lovely thought, isn't it, Jackie?
Isn't it? Yeah. And we have to latch on. My approach to this production is quite different from the original. The original toured Ohio and was a part of the Ohio Humanities Council offerings. and there was discussion afterward, and it was fair. There were four people who did it. We have a larger cast. I've added a few more references in terms of our knowledge of Japanese culture, because that's who we are as Hawaii. But I've also used more of the arts to interpret the feeling and meaning behind the story, having the dancers really bring what it was like to have an explosion and have the blast move through the town, having the taiko there. There's a heartbeat races when you see the visuals. There are projections and such. I wanted the arts to help us feel deeply and really add that emotive element to something that we're still grappling with.
I think if anything can, it's going to have to come through the arts, don't you think?
Yeah, I agree. This came into my hands in a very uncanny way. A professor from the university was at a bed and breakfast up in Ohio, and the hostess said, "Oh, I have this script." So serendipity, and as a reporter at the Tribune Herald said, kismet.
Yeah.
It landed at my door, and we're able to present this. And I'm in my last year at the university. I wanted to do something meaningful, and I'm really pleased that already it's touched our students.
Jackie Pualani Johnson is the director of The Ghosts of Hiroshima, written by Deborah Lubar with Diane Roos. It will be performed tonight at 7:30 in the UH Hilo Performing Arts Center.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, striving to increase awareness and treatment of kidney diseases affecting 1 in 7 Hawaii residents. Learn more at kidneyhi.org.
Since 2012, a coalition of lawmakers headed by Speaker Suki has led the state house. And that's just why a union worked to unseat them. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning and happy Aloha Friday, Beth.
You too. Now, what's with this enmity between the United Public Workers Union and the current speaker?
Nathan Eagle has this story, and it actually kind of caught me by surprise because unions in Hawaii almost invariably give money to Democrats. They're closely in cahoots. They have similar ideology. But in this case, the UPW, which, by the way, it's the second largest public employee union in the state, only after the HGEA.
Right, about 11,000 workers, yeah?
Yeah, blue-collar workers. But, in fact, it appears they want some new House leadership. So not only did Joe Suki not get money, but neither did Scott Sankey, that's the majority leader, and neither did Sylvia Luke, that's the finance chair. Those are the top positions in the House. As well, UPW actually worked aggressively to support people that were other supporters of Joe Suki further down the line, if you will. Why? Well, it appears they want to have Calvin Tsai and Marcus Ashiro back in power. Of course, Calvin Tsai preceded Joe Suki, Marcus Ashiro, the former finance chair. UPW is just not happy with Joe Suki.
This is a fairly recent thing, though, right? Only in the last couple of years has this unhappiness surfaced?
Yeah, that's correct. And it's odd because, I mean, Suki acknowledged that he understood why there might be some unhappy relations between the union and the leadership currently in charge. For example, a couple of years ago, UPW actually did support some Republicans, and that didn't make Joe Suki very happy. He said there was even some GOP literature in the union offices. But this also underscores how there's always been this divide. I mean, literally, we've only had two House speakers for the last really a couple decades, Joe Suki and Calvin Tsai, and it depends on who's got the numbers. So that's why when a union decides to target certain people to try and either knock somebody off or get one of their guys in, that becomes a concern because it is a numbers game. That's how you decide who's going to be speaker, who's got the numbers.
Was that also behind the idea that the union was saying that some of its workers shouldn't be voting in certain races?
Yeah, they actually advise either you vote for this person or don't vote at all in certain races. Leave it blank, which seems just frankly anti-democratic. Joe Suki generally has been a more progressive leader. Same-sex marriage happened under his watch, medical marijuana, dispensaries. Calvin Tse, generally a little more conservative. But the UPW has also got its hands in a lot of other things. Remember the hospital privatization issue that's going on, the Maui area state hospitals. That is a concern, although it is being privatized, right, by the state because it's losing money. It was amazing. UPW actually spent more money than HGEA, which is heavily involved in local elections, the first time in about a decade that we have seen this.
So, Chad, what happens now? I mean, clearly everybody knows now which side each favors. How do we go forward in the next legislative session?
You're going to see. I mean, Suki already announced a lot of his top leadership. They've actually included a couple of former Calvin Tse loyalists. I think he's trying to reward and make sure that he keeps his people. But he has already been selected as a speaker, Scott Psyche returning as well as majority leader. Still yet, Sylvia Luke on finance. I haven't heard the outcome of that. One other thing to add. Remember, there's actually less Republicans now in the House. One of them lost a seat. Only six Republicans in a 51-member House of Representatives.
But will there be any fence mending, do you think? Is that possible?
I wouldn't be surprised if some stuff isn't going on behind the scenes. While the Senate has named a whole lot more of its positions, the House has not publicly made all of its positions known. I think there may be some horse trading going on behind closed doors.
Okay, well, we'll wait and see until that's made public. Meanwhile, have a good weekend, and I will talk to you when I'm back on Oahu on Monday.
Look forward to it. Safe travels, Bethann.
Thanks, Chad. Chad Blair is a reporter with Civil Beat and joins us every day with a reality check. For years, research has often focused on the effects and social impact of one addictive substance at a time. Think about alcohol, meth, heroin. Yesterday, the U.S. Surgeon General took on all of them. Dr. Vivek Murthy estimates that 20.8 Americans struggle with drug and alcohol abuse. Addiction cuts through all socioeconomic levels and geographic areas, and while still regarded by many as a moral failing or evidence of poor character, leading-edge researchers counter that addiction changes how the brain works and should be treated like any other disease. In his Hilo practice, Dr. Frederick Nita has seen what addiction can do. He's been a longtime voice for what he says is an unchecked problem. Dr. Nita joins me now. Good morning. Thank you for coming in.
Good morning. Thank you.
For a lot of us who have heard these very singular attempts to be able to counter drug addiction, that now seems to be changing, at least in somewhat of a national conversation. But as you look at the U.S. Surgeon General's report, what do you make of it? And is this just more conversation in your mind?
I read that last night, and I actually 100% agree with what he's saying. The problem is they need to institute it and do something and follow through on it.
Have there been other instances where there have been similar ideas, but similarly, as you say, have not been followed through?
Well, that's how we got to this problem in the first place. The problem has been here and has been growing dramatically over the last 5-10 years, and nothing has been done to stop it, really.
When you say nothing has been done, for people listening to that who say, well, wait a minute, we've got the DEA, we have a lot of programs that are meant to counter drug abuse, that are meant to stop alcohol abuse.
Those programs, what you're talking about, basically are a failure. It doesn't work. The way things are being run right now, it doesn't work. How can you justify that? Because look at what we see outside. Look at all the homeless people. The majority of the homeless you see in Hawaii are addicted to something or have mental disabilities. Nothing really has been dramatically attacked and solved. There are not enough treatment centers. Every day I have drug addicted mothers that are pregnant, and we cannot find them beds. No matter what anybody tells you, that's the truth. We cannot find them beds.
Because of the fact that they are addicted. They're not just homeless, that the addiction part of it is what stops from finding the beds, or the beds aren't there regardless?
They're not available. I'll give you an example. I have one patient I see probably every other day. She's homeless. She wants to stop. She's pregnant. She's ready to deliver. She goes to the hospital by ambulance every 2 to 3 days, gets checked. We're trying to get her into a program for her and the baby so that she has a chance, but we are not able to get them in. I mean, usually if we're lucky, we can get somebody in maybe in a month. Other than that, what happens, these are actually emergencies. It's like an emergency, and it's not being treated in as an emergency.
So you're saying that this mother who's about ready to deliver could, in fact, be back on the street with a newborn baby?
Well, I don't think that would happen. I believe that what would happen is the child welfare service would come in, take the baby away.
So the mother wouldn't have her child anymore?
Correct. Unless if she could go to a program with the baby, then she possibly could have the baby and try to get clean.
How representative is that story in what you see in your practice?
That's one patient. That happens every day.
Well, that's my question. I mean, how representative is that story of the people that you see in your practice every day?
Well, I'll give you an example. I did some studies before, and for my pregnant patients, 22% were positive for drugs. Then it went to 34. And the last time I took it was over a year ago, was 44% of the pregnant patients were on drugs.
And you've been doing the tox screenings on your own?
Well, years ago, I started doing them, but we didn't know what to do as far as charging, so we just would eat the cost of it. And then we started charging, but I don't know, as you know, I got in trouble for that because they said that was the wrong code and it's not medically necessary to drug screen the pregnant patients, and that's actually got charged with fraud, and I went to court twice.
As you look at this going forward, though, that the situation hasn't changed.
No, it's getting worse.
And you've said that it's getting worse now. What do you do as a doc in Hilo trying to combat it any way that you can? And has there been any movement with the insurance agency to know that this is something that would be in, if not just the patient's interest, but public interest to know who is on drugs?
Well, I think the bigger picture is this. The insurance industry is there to make money. That is their concern. So that should answer what you're asking.
But we already have a doctor shortage.
It's going to get worse, and it is getting worse.
So that coupled, you sort of look at this very difficult situation that we're faced with a doctor shortage. You say that the drug addiction problem in Hilo is getting worse. You're seeing more patients, pregnant mothers who are addicted, more children that will feel the effects of that, the social cost of that, which will be borne by everyone else. What do you think is going to take to be able to get that equation understood better than it is now?
My opinion is that the leadership, meaning the government, needs to take this.
Do you mean federal or state?
Both. And not just talk about it. Decide that we're not going to accept this. And once you find somebody that's going to say, I'm not going to accept this anymore, whatever we need to do, we're going to change it. We're going to fix it. We're going to be creative. We're going to think of new things. And we're going to implement them for the betterment, not only of these pregnant girls, the babies, the partners, and actually this touches everybody, the whole community. Everybody over here is afraid now. Everybody is starting to get alarms. They're locking their doors. They're getting dogs. They're getting cameras. And the reason is everybody is afraid.
Afraid of what's happening because it's escalating? Because more drugs are coming into
Hilo? They're getting broken into. A lot of robberies, thefts, break-ins. I mean, you know, the reality is, obviously, for a lot of these drug addicts, the local ones, they have families here to take care of them. They could get help, but they burned that bridge. So there's nothing left. So they end up on the street. And how do you support your habit? It's only two ways, either steal or, as the young girls, I see 15-year-old girls doing this, prostituting themselves.
When you say that someone has to make the decision at a governmental level that, you know, this is not going to go on, enough already, what does that really mean to you, aside from the words to say, you know, we're not going to stand for this anymore? What would have to happen?
You get a bunch of people that actually are committed to to getting this done, no matter what, and you listen and you implement new strategies to quickly get it done.
So what's a quick strategy in your mind? Because clearly you've thought about this for a very long time that you've been dealing with this.
I actually have all the things that I've thought of, and I actually gave it to the department. I helped somebody.
And what did they say?
They said that's the best ideas they ever heard, but as far as will anything happen of it, probably not.
No discussion about if there are such great ideas, why they're not being implemented?
No answer to that.
And have you had ongoing discussion with the Department of Health?
Yes.
And still no answer to all of that?
Yes.
So you're looking for somebody at a higher level to be able to tell the Department of Health that these are ideas worth pursuing?
Well, I don't really care whether it's Department of Health, DHS, whoever it is, it doesn't matter to me. It's just you need to think of creative ideas and implement them and do it. There's no time to waste.
Meanwhile, are you continuing to be a voice for this in Hilo, and has this caused you, or will this cause you greater risk potentially?
Well, I accepted all of that risk already. I've gotten threats so many times, but honestly, that doesn't bother me because I committed my life to say I'm not going to tolerate this. Why? Because my own family has addiction. So I will not tolerate it.
Dr. Nita, we'll talk more in future. Wish we had more time now. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Dr. Frederick Nita is a Hilo obstetrician gynecologist. He received his medical degree from the University of Hawaii John A. Burns School of Medicine and has been in practice for more than 20 years, during which he says the addiction epidemic in Hilo has exploded.
If that person next to me coughs or sneezes, will I catch his cold? I'm Ira Flatto. Join me on Science Friday as we take a deep dive at the common cold, where scientists think it came from, and the evidence behind your home remedies.
Gargle salt water.
Zinc lozenges.
Homemade chicken soup.
Ginger tea. A little bit of honey.
That's on Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
Helping people.
It made me feel good.
Taking care of people.
It's just something that you want.
I wanted to help.
Hi, everyone. This is Bob Wehrman. It's time for The Benevolent Mind, our quest to discover the spark that ignites giving. Dr. Angel Yanagihara is attacking a devil of a problem. Lurking in the watery depths, no one knows where, are millions of beautiful ghost-like creatures. When the moon is full, they rise to the surface, and about a dozen days later, invade our south-facing shores. Yes, they're beautiful. The trouble is, they're highly poisonous. I'm referring to Charybdis alata, or as we know them, box jellyfish. They have microscopic spring-loaded threads called nematocysts that launch into whatever touches them, and this sting is extremely painful. One tiny envenomation can make a grown man cry and may cause anaphylactic shock. The Hawaii Community Foundation's Hawaiian Box Jellyfish Venom Grant has been funding Dr. Yanagihara's anti-venom research for several years, and her work has been successful, for she developed a gel that mitigates the stings. As many as 350 people have been stung on a single day, and speaking from personal experience, I can say, thank you, Dr. Yanagihara. Our program is a production of Hawaii Public Radio and is sponsored by the Hawaii Community Foundation, believing for 100 years that philanthropy is all about you.
Support for the conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, announcing a fall open house where parents can learn more about the school's educational experience this Sunday, November 20th at 2:30. SacredHearts.org.
Earlier in the show, we told you about the milk bottle cap game played by many keiki during the 30s, 40s, and 50s. They would collect caps from various island dairies to use in pickup games, where players placed equal numbers of discs on a stack, art side up. Whoever's turn it was would try to hit the stack with a slammer and win the caps that had flipped. When milk bottles were no longer in production, Haleakala Dairy's marketing manager, Charlie Nalepa, dreamed up the plan of giving away milk caps imprinted with the trademark name Pog to promote the company's passion fruit orange guava drink. The name stuck as kids started calling the round discs and the game Pogs. Interestingly, the U.S. military has also printed Pogs for use by deployed soldiers. With values of 5, 10, and 25 cents, this quasi-currency is used overseas by deployed soldiers, issued by the Army and Air Force Exchange Service in charge. The main reason for the paper discs was to offset the cost of shipping heavy American coins overseas. And Jerry Shee from Honolulu, who has his own military POG collection, called and had the right answer to today's quiz. Congratulations. And if you've got a quiz for us, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. The Lyman Museum and Mission House in downtown Honolulu's stated mission is to tell the story of Hawaii, its islands, and its people, and it's in a unique position to do just that. It's built around one of the oldest houses in the island, the Mission House itself, and is a repository for priceless memories of the past two centuries. Bruce McClure is a museum trustee as well as a docent there. He's on the line with us from Hilo. Good morning, Bruce.
Morning, Chris. Thank you for having us.
Sure. You've kind of made the museum and Mission House your personal mission as well. Is that right?
Yes, I have. Since retiring, it's really captured me, and I enjoy sharing our story.
Which is what? What is your story, Bruce?
Well, we're one of several mission houses throughout the islands. Kauai, Maui has two, Oahu has one. Mm-hmm. We're the youngest of the surviving mission houses.
Going back to what, 1830?
1839 it was built.
Uh-huh.
It was renovated in 56, and then it was moved in 1930 from its original position to where it is today.
Judging from the photographs I've seen, Bruce, it was renovated in very, very accurate period style, yeah?
Yeah, it was a thatched house with a large attic, and that was removed, and they added a second story and moved the attic up. It still does have, though, the original 1839 Ohia beams in it, which is quite something.
Well, along with any kind of an artifact like that come all kinds of human memories as well, right? The lives of people in those days.
Yes. One of the requirements for the group that sent them out, the ABCFM, the American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions, that the grown-ups had to keep a journal. And we have both David and Sarah, so those are the two original, and then other journals are in other locations. So we have very detailed accountings of these people, what they're expecting, what they see, and what their reactions are.
It sounds as if they had posterity in mind in keeping those journals, yeah?
It does. It does very much.
Well, and that's, you kind of wish that in any period of history that more people had done that, because history is a series of the stories of individual people, don't you think?
Yes, they are. We're Hawaii. We're really lucky because we have, all of the old newspaper articles that were from 1834 through 1948 in Hawaiian, of the Hawaiians telling their own story.
And most people don't realize that Hawaii was one of the most newspaper-intensive countries in the world in the 19th century, yeah?
Yeah, we were. As I said, the first newspaper printed west of the Rocky Mountains was at Lahaina Luna in 1834 on the original printing press, the one that the first group brought. It's kind of bus up, but they sent it to Maui to use, and so... Yeah, that's where we get our first newspaper, in Hawaiian.
And there were, what, dozens of Hawaiian language papers, yeah?
Yeah, there were.
You know, one of the projects that you folks have embarked on is this thing of asking people to look at the photographs in one particular family archive, the John Howard Pierce photo exhibit.
Yeah, he passed his negatives to us, and there are over 5,000 of them. And so we've had two viewings now that we've printed up several ones. And every week, our local paper, the Hawaii Tribune Herald, prints one, and we ask people, you know, who is this? We have the photos, but we don't have good descriptions. We know the data was taken, but that's about it. So it's really awoken the community. We have a lot of people show up, and they go, oh, yeah, that's Auntie so-and-so. And once we make contact with her, oh, yeah, this is Silva, and this is so-and-so. And so it's really been fun. So we're on our second one, and we'll probably do another in the future.
Kind of like rummaging through somebody's attic, yeah?
Yeah, we are that attic for Hilo.
Well, I think that's kind of what a good museum is. It's also the project is a reminder, Bruce, that it's not just the past, that it's an ongoing, you know, there's always something new to learn, yeah?
Right, and today's, we're going to be tomorrow's history, so we should continue to keep those things.
The other activity that the museum goes in for is a number of educational events, right?
Yeah. Most springs, we get a lot of the fourth grade students from various schools from around the island and also from on island. We found that on island that some of our schools can't come. So one of our programs for this coming year is Holo Holo Lai Mana program. And it's going to bring hands-on cultural workshops to schools on the Big Island that are unable to get to us because of the schedule. They're too far out. They, you know, by the time they leave, they won't get back in time, or the costs are just too prohibitive for them. So we're really looking forward to doing that. Our first one is in December.
You get good reactions from the kids when you bring the museum to them, or when you bring them to the museum?
Yes, we've had a series. We always do well. They have such fun here.
Well, I certainly, you know, I think all of us who went to museums as kids have similar memories of, you know, discovering new fascinations. Yeah.
Yeah. And because of that, we're renovating our upstairs, our island heritage. Basically, the museum's divided into two parts. The lower part, our island or natural history, and the top part, its people. So we're working on to complete redesign and renovation, and we're scheduled to open that in 2018. And so that's really going to be exciting.
Which goes back to what we were saying about the ongoing mission, yeah?
Right. We try and, you know, keep fresh, and as our viewpoints change and stuff, things change.
I would bet, Bruce, that visitors, you know, mainland visitors who come to the museum find that they've learned a lot more than they thought they would.
Yes. We get lots of comments, people that were surprised. You know, here's this little thing, and they say, okay. But they're surprised at the content, the quality, and also the history that they had no idea about. For our local people, one of the ones I like to do is just local street names. There are all kinds of stories there, and that's one of the homework I give the kids when they leave. They got to go find a Hawaiian street name. They can't look up Plumeria or Lokelane.
Uh-huh.
You know, they got to look up like Manono Street, or in Honolulu you have Liliha Street. Everybody knows the bakery and the good things. That was Boke's wife. He was governor of Oahu, and that was his wife, and that's the famous picture of the beautiful Hawaiian couple. And oh, wow, that's the street. Oh, my goodness. I drive it every day, you know. And so, yeah, there's history right out there that we walk up and down every day.
That's a good good message to keep in mind, Bruce. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much, Chris.
Sure.
Aloha.
Bruce McClure is a retired civil engineer who joined the Lyman Museum as a docent, later became a member of the museum's board of trustees, and he holds both positions to this day.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk show programming. Mahalo to contributors Noheya Gallery and Straub Clinic and Hospital.
What percent of the food in American supermarkets do you actually think is food?
The definition of food is something that sustains and nourishes.
Yeah.
And nourishment is something that increases your health. So 40% of the stuff in American supermarkets wouldn't qualify as food.
Wait, 40% wouldn't qualify as food?
Right.
How we connect with our food? That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday at noon, following New Dimensions.
Beth Ann, it's a fitting way to celebrate our new reach to Hilo by having you over there.
It's really been a wonderful morning, and it's now clearing up. We're actually seeing some blue sky. But I'm just thinking a lot about what you were talking about with Bruce McClure a moment ago, and when he said that history is around us every day, and we walk by it every day and don't give it a thought. And maybe we need to give it some greater thought. And I want to thank the Lyman Museum so much for hosting us this day and over the last couple of days, too, during the Victory Drive. We really appreciate all of your hospitality. So that's it for this week. Now, coming next week, Hawaii's Democratic Party may be facing a bit of a conundrum as it comes into the GOP trifecta. We'll come and actually we'll speak with Tim Vanderveer, and we'll talk about the Great Thanksgiving Listen.
And we'll look at an interfaith celebration of Thanksgiving.
You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments anytime you like. It's 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Past shows are archived on the Conversation page on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Ryan Finnerty and Russell Subiono are our production assistants.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll see you on Monday when we pick up The Conversation.